Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everyone. Well, today is Tuesday. It's April 23rd and 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. We're going to begin today by talking to our first guest. The man who will be starting the show with us today is none other than congressional candidate Kenneth, we call him now Kenny Belvin. He's vying to represent the communities comprising District 16 in the 2020 general election. So I see he's already on. Good morning, Kenny. How are you?
I'm good, Hezzy. How are you?
I'm excited to talk to you particularly today. And where I was wondering if the intrigue that's going on about the findings, the Mueller findings, and there's still a tremendous amount of speculation one way or the other. It seems that we haven't moved many people from the left or the right, and the middle is confused, which is always seemingly the case. But does this particular revelation, however you look at it, does it impact, like, you as a candidate vying for office in the U.S. Congress?
Well, excuse me. I think yes. I think that people care about whether or not the president attempted to obstruct justice. I think they care about whether he committed high crimes and misdemeanors. I think they care about that. I also think they care about, you know, the cost of healthcare and, you know, how the environment is going to look like in 10 years. But I also think that they're able to walk and chew gum at the same time. You know, I think, I don't know if the findings of the Robert Mueller report are a kitchen table issue as we have come to know them, but I don't think that means that people don't care about them. And I also think that they expect that members of Congress will do their job in, you know, making sure that we don't have a president that has attempted to commit crimes. So, you know, I think it does impact us in that people want to make sure that representatives in Congress are doing the work that they were sent there to do, because it's not just about passing laws and writing legislation. That is a primary function of the Congress, but it's also to make sure that we're checking the executive. And, you know, I think people want to make sure that representatives are doing that. And that's my biggest concern coming out of this. Like you said, there's a lot of speculation. To me, it's pretty clear what we've seen of the Mueller report, that the president attempted to obstruct the investigation. That seems clear as day to me. And to me, that seems like we should start impeachment proceedings. But that doesn't take away from, as I tell you every week, us knocking on doors, talking to voters about that issue and healthcare and, you know, climate change and all the other issues that we talk about. It's just another thing that we have to make sure that we're talking about and aware of, and that voters know our position on.
Well, I think that really is, I guess, the essence of it all. If you become the congressman, then you're responsible to oversee your jurisdiction as a congressman, but you also need to participate in checking the other forms of government, right? So you have to check on the executive, and I guess the executive checks on the legislature. But, like, for example, it's now almost 2 years, and it seems as a standard that every president has presented their tax returns, and they're still slugging it out at the president's office. The guy who's in charge of the Treasury, what's his name, Mnuchin, he says no, he doesn't need to release it. It goes on and on and on. But this game, why is it so difficult to follow what we know is a standard format? And why does it take so much time the minute someone pushes back? Don't we have formalities?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing with this president, right, we've seen, I think at this point, almost all of the Democratic contenders for president release the last 10 years or so of their tax returns, but we still don't know what's in this president's tax returns. And I think the pushback is that there's something for him to hide. Now, it could be something so minimal, like he's not as rich as he says he is, or and he doesn't want people to find that out. Or it could be that he has shady business dealings in countries like Russia and Saudi Arabia. And we just don't know. And now that we've had a subpoena come out for, you know, his tax returns, and we want to see what's in them. I hope that we will. You know, you're right. It is standard practice for presidents and presidential candidates to release these things. It's kind of a shame that he's gone by 2 years of his presidency without us seeing them, and that presumably he hopes to go another 4 years after the 2020 election without showing us, you know, what he's made and how he's made it. And, you know, the hope is that now that we have a Democratic Congress that we'll get to see those, and we'll get to know whether the president is engaging in shady business practices.
And I would never understood originally, and I had to ask that question of, we have a political analyst, his name is Michael Edelman, who's now moved to Florida for health reasons, but he was here in Westchester County for years, ran for political office. He was an unbelievable, but he smelled this situation with the president a long time ago. So he's been, he's got a derogatory tone about the president, but he's been on target from over 2.5 years ago. So I don't know how he did it. Maybe he had a crystal ball, but I asked him, like, well, what is it that we're going to see in the tax return? He says, well, it shows you where he's borrowed money, who he owes money to, what his contributions are. So a lot is told by the conduct of your conduct, and it's revealed in the tax return. And I had never realized that, I guess because I don't have such a complex life. You know, it's really simple. But in comparison, but these people are business people, and they borrow money from abroad, and sometimes they declare, sometimes they don't. It's really difficult to keep up. Do people recognize all of that? Because I didn't until I asked Michael Edelman. It went over my head.
I think people see it as like an underlying assumption, right? It's not. It isn't hard to piece together that Donald Trump's tax returns would be longer and maybe a little bit more complex than my tax returns or your tax returns, because he's probably got a lot more money to report, and, you know, he has more business activity to, you know, file and all of that. So that's, I think people just kind of assume that, but it's, and that's a fair assumption, right? The guy claims to be a billionaire, so sure, his tax returns would be longer. But what is it that he's hiding, right? If I had $10 billion like he claims to have, and I made that money legally, just good business practices, sound investments, all that jazz, shouldn't you want to show people your tax returns to show that that's true? What is he hiding is my question. And, and to go to your other point, right, you say that Michael called it or whatever 2.5 years ago about what is he hiding in his tax returns or why doesn't he release them. I think people in New York have known forever that Donald Trump is shady and not maybe the greatest person. And now that he's president, we're just watching the rest of the country kind of discover that. But we've known for as long as he's been, you know, a New York figure that, ooh, this guy's kind of sketchy. And now as he sits in the most powerful office in the country and in the world, we're everyone is discovering that together. What we've already known for years.
From a positive perspective, you know, maybe because of his, you know, in-your-face challenge to everything, he's also rattled a lot of people who really wonder why we don't have a more sensitive perspective. Like, for example, he's doing something with the oil crisis, and he's not giving tariffs to certain countries when he's with regard to trade. It's increasing the cost of oil. It's now up to $75 a barrel, and it's crept up along very much, and probably will shoot up even higher. And that impacts not only the world situation, but also impacts us. And how does that sit with people, or do people yet realize that his conduct actually speaks to so many other things.
People are starting to realize, and I think as, you know, the trade war with China and as other tariffs continue to go on,
yeah,
and the price of things like oil, like you say, continue to go up, right? Just yesterday, I drove by the gas station, and I was like, wow, the price of gas has gone up. And as people start to pay more at the pump, or, you know, as we're increasing tariffs on countries that we import food from, as the price of food goes up in grocery stores and everything like that, Americans will start to say, oh, crap, now I'm spending more to buy gas and to buy groceries than I was even last year. And, you know, it's going to start to affect the way people are able to live and buy things, necessities that they need to get to work or to get to school or just to be able to cook dinner for themselves and their family. So I think we're starting to see the effects of that. And you're right, I think he kind of picks and chooses which countries he wants to kind of fight with. And I think even that's a little bit sketchy. And I do wonder if, you know, when we finally do see his tax returns, if maybe an answer will lie in there. If maybe he chooses to be more lenient on countries that he has business dealings in or that he wants to have business dealings in. And that's definitely something that I'm looking forward to finding out if and when we see his tax return.
Well, it's interesting because Michael Edelman says that he's really, he's the president of the United States, but he's really conducting his business as a president to the benefit of his own business. And one of the big things that we found out is that he was hoping to put the name Trump in Russia, and that was going to be worth millions and millions of dollars. And so a lot of those things are starting to come to light, and it's going to impact it. If you become a congressman, you might have an impact on some of this international stuff that goes on that affects the United States. What do you think, for example, of that whole issue in Venezuela? Venezuela, we were talking a good game. The president said, no, the Russians shouldn't be able to land. And now we find out that there's an island right off Venezuela where Russian planes are coming in, more are coming in. The Cubans are also involved. The Chinese are involved. Are we going to be able to salvage, you know, whatever happened to the Monroe Doctrine? I thought, well, we've actually kept Central America, the Caribbean, and South America under this claimed guise of the Monroe Doctrine. We used it over 100 years ago, and it scared the bejesus out of everybody else. But today, hey, it's all fair game, and nobody's listening to this president. So, well, is this a problem as well?
Well, two things. I do think that nobody is listening to this president, and in part, I think it's because they don't, A, they have no idea what he actually believes, and B, they may kind of see him as a bit of a joke because he goes on Twitter and he watches Fox News for 6 hours a day and or has 4 hours of executive time, and they just kind of see it as like, oh, this is not really something that we have to worry about. So I do worry a little bit about American credibility with our allies and, you know, our adversaries, and that's definitely a concern. But when you talk about an issue like Venezuela, the one thing that I do not want is, you know, when the president or one of his advisors, John Bolton, right, when they talk about, oh, well, we may intervene with the military. That's definitely not something that I would want, and is definitely something that I would push back against if elected to Congress, right? We've intervened in foreign countries and their governments for decades now, and it seems that we haven't learned our lesson of instability and chaos and all of that, right? We, in the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, we just kind of toppled governments in Latin America and Africa and in the Middle East, and we're still paying the price for those decisions. And it just seems as we start to kind of bang the drums again of, oh, maybe we need to be involved more heavily in Venezuela, that we haven't learned anything from our own foreign policy mistakes. So while I am concerned about a lot of, human rights abuses that I hear about and read about in Venezuela, and while I think that we should work with our partners there and across the world to solve that problem, what I don't want is for us to continue to take unilateral action to solve problems that end up hurting more people than they help.
No, I don't disagree with that concept, and you know, that's a particular demeanor, and the president is pulling back from every engagement that we were in. Like, we spent trillions and trillions of dollars in Afghanistan in the same way that we left Vietnam. We didn't even negotiate with the Vietnamese. We said we're leaving, and that was it. And that's what Kissinger was able to do, and kept everyone in the pulled out. Same thing's happening now in Afghanistan. We're going to be departing there. But we leave our allies stranded, you know, like we left them in the Kurds in Syria. There's such pushback against the United States. All of a sudden, what's caused the world to become so emboldened to challenge the U.S. by having influence, for example, in Venezuela, and the nations that do support the new guy that is the interim president, Juan Guaido. Mm-hmm. The problem is that I'm not exactly sure. I mean, he's supported by over 50 countries, but Maduro isn't letting go. So Maduro is already, there's like a battle there, but it's on one side. So what do we do? Why have we permitted this? This didn't happen overnight, actually, let's face it. Maduro has been in power there for a long time, and we've tried to use all sorts of things to undermine him, and it hasn't worked. Mm-hmm. So what do we do when we have challenges like that in the world?
Well, I remember, with
Kim, we just found out Kim Jong-un from Korea, you know, he's railing and he's telling the United States, well, he doesn't want this one to negotiate with him. And now we find out that he's going to see Putin. It was declared today that he's going to be seeing Putin. And he speaks, of course, with the Chinese all the time. And then we find out that he's got more missiles that he's testing and stuff like that, and nuclear weaponry. So I don't know. Is the president competent to deal with this? I don't give a hoot if the guy's friendly with this guy, but it's a question of also, how do we protect us? I don't want Guam blown out of the water.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. And I don't know if I think the president is competent enough to deal with issues like this. But what I do think is that we need to start displaying that, A, our main concern is making sure that countries are holding up human rights standards, right? I think that,
yes,
right. I think we used to be that way. I think our concern whenever we got involved in another country's business was that, oh, we were trying to protect the human rights of people who live in those countries. And I think
right.
we need to keep that, right? We need to make sure that people around the world in different countries and for different reasons are being treated properly and not being abused or exiled or killed even
mm-hmm.
when, you know, at the hands of their government. But the thing that I think goes in tandem with that is that we need to make sure that we're not acting alone. Sure, we're the most powerful country in the
right.
world and that's great. But if I walk out, let's say if I'm playing baseball and I walk out onto a baseball field all by myself to go against an opposing
mm-hmm.
team, they're going to look at me and say, well, this guy's all by himself. He can't play this entire
right.
game by himself. And it's the same thing, right?
Right?
We present stronger and more united when we have our allies agreeing with us, when, you know, we have the backing of the United Nations or NATO, let's say. So it's about making sure that when we go to negotiate with people like Kim Jong-un, that we have a solid footing, that we know why we're there negotiating, whether it's to push denuclearization in a country like North Korea or to prevent human rights abuses in a country like Venezuela. We need to make sure that we know why we're there and that we have our allies there with us to make sure that when we say, well, we're concerned about your nuclear progress in North Korea, that the rest of the world is there
mm-hmm.
saying, yeah, we're concerned too, and we don't want to stand for this. It's about having a clear message and a clear goal
right.
in negotiations, right? And the president during the campaign said, mm-hmm. oh, well, I'm a negotiator, so this will be easy for me. Well, we haven't seen that.
Yeah.
So, you know, let's make sure that we're going back to negotiating with a purpose.
Yeah, he's not the deal maker yet. I haven't seen
no.
any deals made. So no. maybe I missed it. But I don't think he's
if you did,
deal.
I did too.
Okay. Well, I feel a little bit better now. So I guess, you know, when you think about a congressional seat, for example, you have tremendous power as one of the members of Congress. And then what would become the major issues for a congressman like you should you enter into Congress? You know, it's starting to question, like, should we be involved in climate change issues? Is it about affordable housing on the local market? Is it about taxation? You know, what's it all about? What do you hope to accomplish when you get into office?
Yeah, so I think one of the main things that pushed me to run for Congress is that I came of age in a world where I saw us having a hand in every single country on the planet. I saw climate change getting worse and worse and nobody dealing with it. The cost of college is outrageous. You know, our infrastructure has a D-plus rating. You know, those issues go on and on, and I've talked about them a lot. But right now I see that we're at such a point in our nation's history that what we need is to take really bold action really, really quickly. And no more of incrementalism. Let's talk about climate change, for example, right? When people talk about the Green New Deal, they talk about, well, how are we going to do these things so rapidly, and do we have to take such drastic action, like making sure that we're 100%, carbon neutral by 2030, right? That's only 11 years from now. We have to do that. And we have to do that because we failed to do it 10 years ago, 20 years ago. And, you know, the same thing when I talk about canceling student debt, right? It's like, well, do we have to do that? That's such a dramatic proposal. Well, $1.5 trillion of student debt didn't happen overnight, right? It built up over 10 years and 20 years, and that's why we have to take this action now. So I think my concern is, yes, you know, if I'm in Congress, I want to focus on the environment. I want to focus on the cost of college, the prison industrial complex, all of those issues. But it's about making sure that there's a voice in Washington that's pushing for bold action right now to take dramatic steps to solve problems that will only get worse if we just try to put together piecemeal solutions. And that won't really get at the root of these problems. So that's my focus, right? Bold change right now. And, you know, some of the proposals will be dramatic, but that's what we have to do. That's the situation. That's the circumstance that we find ourselves in.
Well, can we do something, for example, we incarcerate so many people at unbelievable costs. Cost more to incarcerate somebody than to give them an education at Harvard. I mean, it's really insanity. And yet we don't use those facilities for maybe trying to transition people from whatever they used to do that caused them to get into jail, assuming it's legitimate, because a lot of people get framed and get thrown into jail. Because you really have to wonder if the people of your peers are really doing the right thing when they say, well, we should incarcerate this person. But so all of that coming into play, can we dismantle these prison systems, which are just simple corporate structures now? And I really wonder if they even manage the population well. Do they give them a way to turn their lives around, or they're going to be there forever?
Yeah, I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head, right? A lot of these prisons are run by corporations, so they're just they're kind of built on this corporate structure, and that's I think one of the biggest problems with the prison industrial complex is that it's run in large part by private corporations. So there's a profit motive, right? If I own a prison, how do I make money? By making sure that my prison is full. I make sure that my prison is full by pushing and lobbying for policies like tough on crime laws and strict drug enforcement so that people who people go to prison, predominantly poor people, predominantly, you know, black and brown people, are going to prison for minor low-level drug offenses, but that keeps my pockets full, right? So there's a profit motive when it comes to policing and mass incarceration. And if we could just, you know, lots of people now are talking about getting rid of private prisons. And I think that's a great idea because you take out the profit incentive when it comes to crime and criminal justice, right? There's no reason that anybody should be profiting off of somebody going to prison. And mm-hmm. if we eliminate that profit motive, then we can make sure that people who are in prison are there because they have committed a crime and should be in jail, not because some CEO sitting in a boardroom is concerned that his profits are down last month. So on an issue like that, right, that's simple.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
Maybe we could turn a prison into a school.
Right.
I know it sounds
like you said,
weird, but I guess we could, right?
Right. Like you said, it costs more to incarcerate somebody than it does to educate them. And that's yeah. and that's because, you know, our focus is, oh, well, you've done something wrong, so you have to go immediately to prison. It's almost about vengeance and not about rehabilitation and reintroducing mm-hmm. someone into society after they've committed a crime. And that's why, yeah. you know, our recidivism rate is so high, right? Because people go to prison and our prisons are just kind of like holding cells where prisoners go about their daily day and we don't attempt to rehabilitate them so that when they come back out into society, they can get a job or whatever it is. And then they end up committing a crime mm-hmm. again and they go back into prison and it's a cycle. And if we yeah. were, if we could focus on, and even if, like, for example, private prisons that operate in this country and in other countries, right, their companies operate in the U.S. and Australia, for example. And in Australia, mm-hmm. private prison companies get incentivized to make sure that their recidivism rates are low, that people who go to prison don't come back. And those same
right.
companies operate in America off of the structure that that they would make money if their prisons are full. So we just have to change the way that we view prison reform. And I think it'll go a long way to tackling an issue like that.
Well, that's actually a very compelling argument to show that the same corporate structure, prison corporate structure that operates in Australia operates differently here because the incentive mm-hmm. motive is different. So if you do change the incentive motive, it could become, I guess, more akin to Australia, assuming that they're doing a good job. So yeah. Very, very fascinating. Are people becoming aware of this issue? I've always heard about
so,
it, but I've never really heard any, you know, any real discussion as if it's it's a little coy about bringing it up.
Well, you know, I think people are starting to become aware. You know, I've seen a lot of talk of it, even, mm-hmm. you know, in the last year or two on social media. And I think just the thing is that not everyone in the world is on social media. So it's about educating the rest of the country that doesn't use Facebook and Twitter as often as
mm-hmm.
some of us do.
Right. Right.
And making sure that they know that this is possible.
So are we also then, because in a sense, like, I don't have the time to be time on social media, because I think if I do, then I would just be captivated, you know, totally with it. Not because it's, wouldn't be inebriated with what's going on there. But I found that when I started on, you know, you end up reading about this, that, or the other. A lot of it is very personal stuff, which is really not what I want to spend an hour on.
Mm-hmm.
And then so are we starting to find that we're also dividing our society, you know, from those people who spend time on social media and those people that might be reading news, and then they might also only be reading news from one side and as opposed to another side, and there's no meeting of the minds? Are we starting to divide our nation that way through generational standards?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely a gap in
uh-huh.
people who are using social media and people who are using it constantly and then people who are not.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, mm-hmm. I don't necessarily think that people who, you know, let's say you're on Twitter and all you follow are political reporters and journalists and activists.
Right.
I don't think that those people are any more engaged in the process than someone who's not on Twitter right. all the time. And
no, they're not,
you know, right. And someone who's not on Twitter all the time may be more inclined to go to a town hall with their local representative, for example. So I just think it's about
mm-hmm.
making sure that, you know, okay, if 25% of my constituents are always on Twitter, so they know what's happening, then how do I get to the 75% of the rest of them who don't? right? And it's about just
right.
having conversations face-to-face the good old-fashioned way and making sure that, you know, they're aware of these issues and how we can change them.
I got it. Unfortunately, I can't believe it. The half hour just flew by.
Wow.
So it really is amazing, and I see the next guest is on. But before we go on to the next guest, because I'll be able to give him a little extra time at the other end, the question is, can you tell us about how do people find out more about your campaign effort? I know you've got a website. So how do people reach out to you?
Sure, yeah. So on our website, and just for everyone, that's belvinforcongress.com. If you go to our website, there is a contact us page. It has the campaign's phone number, the campaign's email, mm-hmm. the campaign's Facebook and Twitter and Instagram if you're on any of those. So if
cool.
you check out our website, there's a bunch of different ways to contact us if you ever want to reach out. And we normally try to respond to people pretty fast.
That's very good. Well, I appreciate it. Kenny Belvin, what a pleasure. And I'm really glad that you got started early. You know, it's only 2019, but it seems to be flying by. And before
yeah.
we know it, it'll be 2020. All the best.
Yeah.
Thank you for making the time for our listeners. Thank you, sir.
Yeah.
Be well.
Thanks for having me.
Bye. My pleasure. Bye. Well, I see we've got Tasha Diaz. Let me see if... Okay, hold on a second. Yeah. Good morning, Tasha Diaz. How are you?
Good morning, Hezzy, and good morning, Yonkers. How are you?
Well, you know, I am so thrilled that you came on today. It was not even a whole week since I last spoke to you, but what you discussed on that show, it was last Wednesday, was very, very interesting, because I didn't know a facet about you that I think is a very, very, has a lot of gravitas. It's a tremendous amount of capacity that you've already earned, you know, in what you've been doing in your life, which can be translated into governance. You know, should you be voted in as the next city council member to District 3, to represent District 3, and I think the thing that I found most compelling is your work with, like, your tenants association.
Yes.
How did that come about? Why did you find it so important to form a tenants association? What was the purpose of it?
Well, I felt that it was a purpose to form a tenants association due to the fact that I've noticed in meeting many people within my food distribution program that a lot of people
uh-huh.
don't know their rights or are not informed about their rights. And, you know, I feel as if you're living somewhere, you should be comfortable, you should be able to speak out about what you do and don't like, and we should be able to work together and try to improve things. So my building had a tenants association when I was smaller, and it just faded away. You know, the people got older. Some of them left. Some of them
uh-huh.
passed away. And me being around that dynamic of people made me say, you know, I've seen a lot of good changes, a lot of changes when I was younger. Why is everything
uh-huh.
stagnant? Why is everything stopped now? Because no one is getting involved. So I had to take the initiative to get involved. So what I did was I started my tenants association, and I invited the neighboring buildings in the district to come
mm-hmm.
down and see how I got started. And they loved the program.
Okay.
And what I did was I went with them, and they piggybacked off of me, and I went with them and helped them start their tenants associations. And from then on...
But then... Okay, go on. Sorry.
People have gotten interested. You know, a lot of people didn't even know what a tenants association was. They didn't know what they can do to start it. They didn't know what their rights were. They didn't know anything. And I went around and I got them the tenant handbooks. I got a lot of people the HUD books as well. Like I said, I teamed up with lawyers of the Hudson Valley. And we just went to different meetings, and we just let people speak. We heard their voice. We let them talk, because that's a lot of things. A lot of things, people don't let them talk. You can't help a person
well, okay,
if you're
but
not
before,
listening.
Before you go on, what is it that educated them to know about. So it seems that the old people who passed away or left and moved to other places were not around, and you remembered that there was value. So you resuscitated that old concept. So what is
right.
it that people weren't aware? What rights did they have that they should have been aware so that they could manage their lives in a better way, in a way that they weren't hurt, and it was respectful of the process too. So what is it that tenants don't know?
A lot of these buildings have community rooms, right?
Uh-huh.
Once the tenants
okay.
associations were closed down, they cut off all access to the tenant. I mean, to the community rooms. Now,
really?
If you had, yes, a lot of, including my building, did the same thing. They did the same thing. Mine was
uh-huh.
closed for 26 years, and I got it reopened once I became the president.
Really? 26
what I did
years
was,
they kept it closed? What did they do?
26
did anybody
years.
Even dust the room?
I mean, they used it for garbage.
Really?
They used the room for garbage. So, like I said, a lot of the neighboring buildings, we have community rooms because we always had tenants associations. It just slowly
uh-huh.
died out. So what I did was, you know, when you want to have a function in your building, whether it be a personal function or just a function for the building, I started asking, why can we not have access to that? That is a part
mm-hmm.
of our right to have access to the community room when you have one. I was told
right.
I didn't know what I was talking about. You know, a lot of people threatened me, you know, you're going to have issues.
Really?
You know, yes, there's going to be a lot of backlash. So what I did was I got the HUD book and I got
uh-huh.
The tenant's right book that was put out by the Attorney General's
okay.
office.
Okay.
And I also got a book for human rights as well. So between
uh-huh.
me reading those three books, I call them my Bibles because it helped me save a lot of people, you know, with their buildings throughout the district. I mean, I stopped a lot of evictions. There were people that were pending evictions. I mean, they were just doing things to people that you would say, there's no way that they can do that. But they did. They were.
Uh-huh.
They are not doing
it. So wait a minute.
Or,
so you learned, like, the HUD book that you told me about is the House and Urban Development,
yes.
Housing and Urban Development group. So when the landlord was trying to evict people, under what basis did they try to do that you found in the HUD book and the other books that you were reading and that they weren't permitted to do that? How did we allow that to happen?
Exactly. Nobody was fighting.
We just
that.
Ignorant? We didn't know anymore?
I just think that it's not all ignorance. I just think that people were scared. When someone feels as if their livelihood or their home or their
uh-huh.
job is going to be tarnished or taken away,
right.
people come up and they get scared. And, you know, a lot of the people
okay.
that I've dealt with were disabled. So they felt as if they didn't have a voice. And I had to be
mm-hmm.
for one particular woman, you know, she has
mm-hmm.
MS. And I was her voice.
Yeah.
I was her voice. I was the reason why she got to keep her apartment. You know, I was the reason why she's still here today. And, you know, it felt so good to help her because she watched me grow up. She watched
mm-hmm.
me grow up. So for me to help her was just like something that I was just so happy to do. For the simple
right,
fact that like, she has MS, she is disabled,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I helped her. And not only with evictions, a lot of the seniors, I've also helped in establishing home health aides as well. Not 4 hours.
Really?
I'm talking 24 hours.
People didn't know
that
they would qualify to get a home aide? No?
Some of them didn't know, but some of them just didn't know the steps that they had to take.
There's a process as well?
Yes, there is a process.
Oh, okay.
A lot of people don't know, but I took care of my grandmother, Mary Blackman, for 10 years.
Uh-huh.
This year in July will be 4 years. She will be deceased. She taught me
a lot.
My mother was a single mother. My father was around here and there, but my mother was a single parent. She worked. My grandmother taught me everything I know, from cooking to cleaning to going out to politics. I mean, back to Joe Farmer days, my grandmother would have me out there. Yes.
Wow.
My grandparents, George Blackman, he worked for the school system.
You don't even
look
old enough to remember Joe Farmer. I mean, really now?
I can tell you exactly where he lived, on Park Hill. My grandparents used to take us there to that big, beautiful house right there on Park Hill.
Yeah. Wow. Fantastic.
And,
I
took for 10 years. And it was a lot of trials and tribulations that I had to go through, and I never gave up. When one door closed, another one opened. You know, I didn't keep her in a nursing home. I took her home. I was able to learn how to administer medication through a feeding tube. I learned how to clean a feeding tube. I took classes for things like this because I wanted her to be home, and I wanted to be close to her. And her doctor even told us as a family, if we didn't take care of her the way we did, she probably wouldn't have made it for 10 years. And the problem was she died of natural causes. She had a stroke. She lived through the stroke. She died of natural causes. She outlived the feeding tube. The feeding tube stopped working. That's one of the reasons why, you know, she started getting feeding intravenously.
Right.
Her heart, everything
that's
was
amazing.
Healthy.
Mm.
And I put 10 years of my life to the side to take care of my grandmother, and I would never, ever change that. Never. The only thing I would change is I wish she was here today to see me, what I'm going through right now. Because I know she would be honored and she would be happy because she taught me everything that I know.
And that's very, interesting. Very good.
Spreading
Go
it
ahead.
Around. I just been spreading my knowledge around to different people, and that's why people are opening up. You know, I helped a person in my building. She passed away about 2 years now, but I helped her obtain a 24-hour home health aid to stay there home with her because her family couldn't do it. And, you know, Mercedes didn't want to go into a nursing home. And I helped her, you know, through the personal care and, you know, I went through different avenues, and I guided her to make sure she got the services she needed.
Okay.
And I've done that with many of people, whether it be services through home health aid, whether it be, you know, services pending eviction. I've gotten lawyers for them. I've actually went to court with them. I've actually called the management company, you know, and tried to reconcile different issues that went on, you know, to stop it before it even went to court.
Okay. And I guess a lot of people don't realize that they can actually engage, you know, people who might want to evict them and to work out some sort of an agreement. Is that the problem? We don't talk to one another as much as we used to? Maybe it wasn't so good in the old days either. You know, I don't even know. Everyone talks about the good old days. I don't know how good they were. You know, it seems that there's a lot of stuff that wasn't so good years ago. Maybe I've been around too long. I don't know.
You know, at least back then, freedom of speech, people vocalized that more. You were more outspoken.
Okay.
Now everything is on a hush-hush and, don't say that. Don't say this. But I mean, if the person needs help and you know what the other party is doing to the person is not right, why don't people step in more? Why don't people want to help more?
I don't know.
I mean,
I really don't know myself.
I think we could be more unified if we come together and we sit and we listen to each other and we don't try to bash each other or badger each other. If we just come together as one and just sit down and listen to each other's issues or problems, we may have the same issues or problems. It's just that we're, you know, it's different ways to address them.
So actually, go ahead.
I just feel like the third district. I just feel as if the third district needs nurturing. It needs nurturing. It needs that extra TLC because there are good people in Yonkers that want to help. It's just that everybody's scared to speak out.
What is it that's causing people to be scared to speak out? Are they afraid of losing a job? I don't know. I don't know what can conceivably happen. What's the problem nowadays?
Afraid of losing a job. It could be afraid of losing your housing. You know,
Yes.
And you don't know these things until you go out in the community. If you're not out in the community, you would never know that people are really going through these things. And we look at it like, oh, it's something so petty, you know. Your landlord can't do that. Like, for instance, I can give you an example. One of the buildings give out the rent receipts, right?
Yeah.
The superintendent had an issue with one of the tenants. So the tenant stopped receiving her rent receipt. So she said to me, you know, Mrs. Diaz, I'm not receiving my rent receipt, and I don't want to get put out. What should I do? I said, well, let's contact the office and let them know that you're not receiving your rent receipt, and let's see, you know, where we can take it from there. I was told by the rent office that is a luxury. We don't have to furnish a rent receipt. You know, they just went on and on. I said, okay, no problem. So I said to the young lady, I said, so this is what we'll do. Every month you write a check. You'll write the check. And we'll send them the check, and, you know, you'll have your canceled check as your copy.
Right.
The building stopped taking her check. They started sending her check back to her. And they were putting it down as if she owed. Yes. And they were putting it down as if she owed an X amount of dollars in rent in order to pull her into court. So what I started having her do was the money that they were sending back to her, I had her put it in escrow.
Yeah.
And when they sent her the paperwork,
and
when they sent her the paperwork to go to court, they probably figured that she would not have her money because it was 3 to 4 months built up.
Right.
When we went to court, I went to court as her representative, and she had a lawyer from the Hudson Valley.
Legal aid?
Legal service.
Okay.
Hudson Valley. And we went into court, and they were shocked to know that she had this money.
Mm-hmm.
So we went into court, we paid the money, then it went from that to, you know, they had an issue saying, oh, you know, your son broke the refrigerator. We're going to have to charge you $650 for the refrigerator in order for you to get it fixed. So this woman, yet again, didn't know, she signed this paper for $650 for a refrigerator. So when I went to her house and she's telling me this and she's showing me this paper, I said, well, where's the new refrigerator? She said, I never received it. How are they charging you for something that you've never received? I have a problem with that because that's like going into the store and I paid for something and I didn't receive what I paid for.
Right.
So I brought the management up and
so
I said,
are people that scared? Are people are that scared that she didn't even know what to do?
Yes.
So
because
people
the first
look to you for guidance.
Yes, they do, because they know that as long as it's right and it's within the guidelines, I will fight for the tenant, and they know that. From me growing up here, they know that. So once I called for her about
What's the problem with a landlord? Why would they want to give this woman a hard time?
Because
is there any way to go back at the landlords? What do they want? They want to get the apartment and charge more money for it. Is that the big issue?
Exactly. You hit it right on the nose. Exactly. So what they do is they push people out. Some people. Let me tell you. There was a young lady that I won a court. I went with her to court. Okay. Last name is Koo. I went with her to court. She won her court case. She was still so scared to stay in the building, she ended up leaving. She still left.
Really?
And she won hands down. She was just so scared that, you know, I won. But what if they come back at me with something else? What if I don't win that fight? You know, what if you're not here?
Right.
What if you're not around? Mm. She got so scared she left. And she had a newborn baby. And she got up and she left.
Really?
After winning her court case. And this is what the landlords do. They push people out, and it's not right. And that's one of the reasons why I formed not only mine, but neighboring tenants associations.
Okay. And when you think about all these issues that you've been engaged with and that you're aware of from your own personal stuff and also by listening to people, do you think that this is one of the big issues that would impact the third district? I mean, is housing, affordable housing, senior
yes.
housing, all these
yes.
issues, do they come into play?
Of course, along with schools.
Uh-huh.
Of course.
Those, right.
those are one of the most issues, I think, that are on the top. For the simple fact that I've, mm-hmm. I've seen it, I've lived it, and I know what the people are going through.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I met a woman on Carroll, right off
yeah.
of McLean Avenue, the Carroll, C-A-R-R-O-L-L. I went
right.
over there, I met a wonderful woman. She signed my petition, and she was telling me what her landlord is doing to her. She had to go as far as to get an order of protection. Can you – I mean, it really has gotten that bad. She has to get an order of protection from her landlord because she was scared because she said every time she turned around, there was an issue with him. And when she tried to address something like, you know, could you fix the ceiling, he would give her a lot of backlash. And she said, you know, I would come out of my house and it's pitch black. And I would say, you know, could you fix the light? He would give me an issue.
Mm.
You know, she said he would tell her she couldn't open up her window. And I'm like, how do you rent a place and he's telling you that you can't open up your windows? I mean, it's just to the point where they feel as if these people have Section 8 or different programs that they feel like that they can rule them. And it's not right.
Mm-hmm.
And these people feel as if they don't have a voice. And I have to be that voice for the people. I have to. I have a lot of people that are counting on me. And
mm-hmm.
I have to deliver. I have to. Yonkers has made a lot of strides in the positive and right directions, but it needs that push. It needs that person, that
mm-hmm.
boisterous person that's going to go out and stand up for the community. It's people before politics. And it should be nothing
uh-huh.
else. The people should come first. The people are who put you in office. The people are the ones that vote for you. The people are the ones that you need. So we should be there for the people. A lot of people get it wrong. We work for the people. The people don't work for us. And if they get
mm-hmm.
it right, I think we'll be off to a good start. And I'm going to go out there day one and start for the community. I've been out here.
How do people even learn? How do people even learn that you were involved in all these different things, like forming the tenant association and listening to people's plight and so on and so forth? How did they learn about you? Or is it just because you've lived here so many years and people have become aware of you and your parents in the past? Is that how your name got around?
Well, that, me living here, and also, you know, my family, you know, always helped
mm-hmm.
within
mm-hmm.
politics. My aunt Beverly Blackman,
oh.
you know, like I said, my grandmother, my mom, my grandfather,
uh-huh.
my aunt, you know, we were all poll inspectors and things. You know, we started working
right.
on, you know, volunteering on campaigns and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I do have a big family. My family stretches all throughout Yonkers, you know, Mount Vernon, New Rochelle. So the Blackman last name, that's my maiden last name, Black, it's a real big family. And we've just always been out. So, and then when I started my tenants association, the people that watched me grow up, like Deborah Baker, Edna Turan, you know, a lot of people like that, they knew me. So what they did was they brought people to my meetings as well, and that's how it grew. I had a couple of elected officials that came out to my meetings as well. You know, Evan Inlaw came to a couple of meetings that I had. I had some friends and had a couple of meetings. Sabatino
yeah.
came to a couple of my meetings. You know,
uh-huh.
I just reached out to everyone.
Okay.
And word got around. We got a request from 28 Lamartine. You know, they wanted us to help them start a tenants association. I don't know if
mm-hmm.
you're familiar with Dennis Henready. He has an office in
no.
Mount Vernon. He's very big in
no.
housing, and he works
mm-hmm.
with like HUD and Section 8. Dennis Henready
uh-huh.
is awesome. He's been around for many, many years. So
yeah.
me being known in the community and me forging, I guess, relationships, a lot of people
uh-huh.
have heard about me. And that's how I got known. I mean, you know, people say I'm on this board, I'm on that board. I'm on boards as well, but I don't push with boards I'm on because I'm trying to start my own board. I'm trying to start my own boards. You know, I want to have something fresh, something new, you know, for people to jump on board. Now, we don't want the same old people. We need to get the community involved. Let the community have a say-so. And that's another issue. They don't let the community speak. And I let them speak.
Really? I was going to ask you about that. Who's keeping the community at bay? Why would they want that? Don't they want the public to be aware and engaged?
I mean,
or they don't
want
it engaged?
No. Only for certain, when it's beneficial for certain things, they want them to be engaged.
Uh-huh.
And it's not right.
And do people realize that they get pushed out of the equation and that they're not, no one's interested in them? That's got to be very hurtful to think that you're not regarded as a human being and worth listening to and hearing.
I didn't know it was that bad. Yes, they're noticing now people come when they run and they never see them again. Or people only, you know, when they're getting ready to run, they come around and they never see them again. They know me.
Okay.
I'm going to always be here. I've been here. I'm going to be here. I'm not going anywhere. As long as the man upstairs wakes me up every morning and gives me the willpower to do what I do, I will continue to do this.
Okay. Well, that's very important. I just had no idea that so many people felt they were pushed out of the equation, whether it be in housing or whether it be not being allowed or included in so many of these things. So that really is amazing. Because certainly many people in the past have not been inclusive of the communities that they claim to serve, wherever it happens to be.
Right.
So that's really a very annoying. But I didn't realize that people who would be vying for office were aware of that. You evidently are, so that makes you very, very different in a good way. So quite a lot about what you've been doing also informs you on how to conduct your business as a council person, right?
Yes.
Is that what you realize?
It's hand in hand.
Very, very interesting. Well, how do people learn a little bit more about you, Tasha Diaz?
Well, I have a campaign page, Tasha Diaz
for
Council. Yes, and they can also go to TashaDiazForCouncil@gmail.com. That's my email. They can reach me on Instagram, Tasha Diaz for Yonkers as well. I've been out here getting up traction. You know, I'm getting good vibes. I'm getting a good response. And today's a beautiful day. I'll be out today.
Yeah.
Back on the grind again today. I'll be out there as I was day one. And I'll continue to be out there. They're going to get tired of seeing my face.
It's so pretty. I mean, why would they get tired of you looking at your face?
It's amazing. She's persistent. She's consistent. And, you know,
well, I feel
that's the only way we can get things done. Yes.
Well, you know, if you're persistent, Tasha, you know, eventually they get to love you. You know, so, you know, in case they're on the wrong side of the equation, you never know. But I guess everyone's got their idiosyncrasies, so I don't know why they might want to run away from you, but that's okay. You'll be there though anyway, in case they want to go across the street. Well, that's great. I want to thank you for making the time. I look forward. We're going to speak again in another 2 weeks. So there's a lot going on, and more things that will be happening. There'll be stuff going on in Yonkers with regard to the budget process, so we might be informed about things like that as well. There's a lot of stuff on the table, my gosh.
Yes, and I'm ready.
Yeah.
I'm ready. It's exciting.
Well, that is fantastic. Well, you'll have to share with us what you're ready for because evidently it's responsive to a lot of the ills and the trials and tribulations of Yonkers. Well, that's okay.
Right.
Thank
right.
you again, Tasha. What a pleasure.
Thank you
oh,
for
you
having
know, I
me.
To ask you said you said your last name, the family name is Blackman. Before you took on your married name, but wasn't there not even a mayor of Mount Vernon whose last name was Blackman?
No,
was
Blagg.
A relative?
Blagg.
Oh,
no, it was.
Oh, okay.
It's Blagg, B-L-A-G.
Okay, with
Blagg.
A G. Okay, that's where.
Yes.
Okay, very good. Well, that's okay. That's that too. So. Maybe they'll be calling out your name and say, oh, you remember Tasha Diaz? You know, she's the council member of the 3rd District.
Yes.
So you'll start a new legacy, which will be nice.
Yes.
All right, all the best, Tasha. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Patsy, for having me.
My
I look
pleasure.
Forward to speaking. Okay. Bye-bye.
And as do I. All the best. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, how exciting. Tasha Diaz, she's running for the 3rd district in the Yonkers City Council. And we'll see how that goes. I think everyone's already handed in their applications for the signatures that they gathered in order to be on the ballot. And there's still a process that we're going through now. And eventually the ones that are left standing will actually challenge in a Democratic Party primary. And Tasha Diaz, she's running under the Democratic Party line. So very, very interesting. We'll see. At the moment, I think there are 3 people who are running as Democrats. I don't think there's a There is 1 Republican, so there are 3 Democrats and 1 Democrat that is also a Republican. I can't figure that one out, but whatever. You know, maybe I just don't get it all, you know, but we'll have to go, we'll go through that process later on. I just don't have enough time to write all this stuff up, but I will, so not to worry. Anyway, so that's a process. So we'll have to see who survives the Democratic primary, and then we'll see where it goes from there. And that may be decided, the primaries are all going to be decided on June 25. So we'll see who's still left standing, and we'll go from there. And then, of course, there's the general election later on in case there's more than 1 party candidate running for office. So we'll see. All right, let's get back to some other issues, and let's take a quick break and find out what they're doing over at the Yonkers Tribune, and then we'll be back.
The Yonkers Tribune, named Home of the Acid-Tongued Bloggers by the New York Times, is a multifaceted news organization dedicated to keeping the citizens of Yonkers and Westchester informed via the internet and radio. Hezzy Aris is the tireless publisher, editor, and radio host of the Yonkers Tribune. He is a balding, bearded gnome, equipped with a digital camera and a steno pad at all times. Hezzy is frequently spotted in local meetings, translating the events into a Baroque prose style with an infusion of well-mannered outrage. The Yonkers Tribune attracts an informed, well-educated, affluent audience who hungers to know more about politics in all its permutations and nuances. Politics, says Hezzy, is our forte. Advertising inquiries are always welcome. Please call Hezzy Aris at 914-562-0834 or send an email to ehezi@hush.com.
Welcome back. This is Westchester on the Level. Now, in case you want to reach out to the Yonkers Tribune, you could reach them at a new phone number that they have now. It's 347-415-4326. So 347-415-4326. It's their office number. It's their cell number. It's their voicemail number. And it's a text number. So that's the reason they have the number. Well, let's find out what's going on in the world. The tragedy that took place, the massacre that took place in Sri Lanka, has now been claimed by the Islamic State for their being responsible for the Easter attacks. So the Islamic State group claimed responsibility for a series of deadly attacks on Sri Lankan churches and hotels that killed more than 320 people on Easter Sunday, but did not offer supporting evidence for the claim. Now, the Islamic State group on Tuesday said it was behind a devastating string of suicide attacks against churches and hotels in Sri Lanka that killed more than 320 people on Easter Sunday. The claim emerged more than 48 hours after the near simultaneous blasts tore through three high-end hotels popular with foreigners and three churches packed with Christians marking Easter. Now, the Sri Lankan government had already pointed the finger at a little-known local Islamic extremist group called National Tawhid Jamaat, NTJ. So National Tawhid Jamaat, but said it was investigating whether they had international support. Prime Minister Ranil Wickremesinghe said he believed the Easter Sunday attacks had links to the Islamic State group. Quote, "We will be following up on the Islamic State group claims. We believe there may be links," Wickremesinghe told reporters at a press conference in Colombo, the capital of Sri Lanka, today. Now, security agencies were also monitoring Sri Lankans who had traveled abroad to join the Islamic State in Syria and had returned home, said Wickremesinghe. Now, and just so you know, the Sri Lankan Prime Minister is Ranil Wickremesinghe, and just in case you didn't realize it and I didn't mention it. Well, evidently the bombings are a retaliation for the New Zealand mosque attacks, so it's been considered to be. So the Sri Lankan Defense Minister Ruwan Wijewardene told Parliament that the Easter Sunday bombings were, quote, carried out in retaliation for the March 15 attacks on mosques in a church, a Christ church in New Zealand. The Office of New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern said she was aware of the comments linking the Sri Lankan attacks to the Christchurch mosque attacks, but she had not, quote, seen any intelligence upon which such an assessment might be based, end quote. Now, the statement added that the Sri Lankan investigation into the attack is in its early stages. Now, this, the Islamic State group statement claims that the attack, which was released by the jihadist organization propaganda agency AMAQ, M-A-Q, made no reference to the Christchurch bombings. Now, police sources in Sri Lanka told Agence France Presse that the attackers who targeted two of the hotels hit Sunday were Muslim brothers, sons of a wealthy Colombo spice trader. Their names were not immediately revealed, but they were said to be in their 20s. Guests were lining up for breakfast at the Shangri-La and Cinnamon Spice hotels when the two men detonated their bombs. A fourth attack against a hotel on Sunday failed, sources told Agence France-Presse, though it was not immediately clear if the bomber's explosives had failed or he had chosen not to detonate them. He later blew himself up when police tracked him to a lodging in the capital. And police have detained at least 40 people as they investigate the worst act of violence in Sri Lanka since a civil war ended a decade ago. On Tuesday, grieving Sri Lankans began to bury their dead, and the country observed a day of national mourning. Well, 3 minutes of silence were marked nationwide from 8:30 local time in the morning, the time the first suicide bomber struck on Sunday, unleashing carnage. Flags were lowered to half-mast on government buildings, and liquor shops were ordered closed for the day. Hours earlier, the government imposed a state of emergency, giving police and the military special powers, including the ability to arrest suspects without a court order. more than 1,000 people gathered on Tuesday at St. Sebastian's Church in Negombo, north of the capital, which was among those devastated in the blast, to pay tribute to the dead. An elderly man wept uncontrollably by the coffin bearing the body of his wife, while relatives of other victims stood aghast and silent. The coffins were carried into the church grounds one by one for services, and then to a newly established cemetery on church land. Beyond words, said Father Suranga Wanakula Suria, who had come from another parish to help conduct funerals. It's very hard to bear. For me, it is very difficult. So imagine how hard it is for the loved ones. The attacks were the worst ever against the country's small Christian minority, less than 7% of the 21 million population. Officials are investigating why more precautions were not taken after an April 11 warning from Sri Lankan's police that, quote, a foreign intelligence agency had reported the NTJ planned suicide attacks on churches. On Monday, government spokesman Rajita Senaratne said the warning was not passed on to Prime Minister Wickremesinghe or other top ministers. So relations between Sri Lankan President Maithripala Sirisena and Prime Minister Wickremesinghe have been strained since Sirisena fired Wickremesinghe last October over political differences, only to reinstate him weeks later under pressure from the Supreme Court. But at a press conference on Tuesday, Wickremesinghe appeared to downplay the rifts within his coalition government, and investigators were making good progress identifying culprits behind the attacks, he said. Our priority is to apprehend the offenders where whatever we have. We have to sort it out between ourselves, said Wickremesinghe. More details have begun to emerge from some of the foreigners killed in the blast. The U.S. reported at least 4 Americans killed, including a child, and the Netherlands raised their toll to 3. A Danish billionaire lost 3 of his children in the attacks, a spokesman for his company said. 8 Britons, 10 Indians, and nationals from Turkey, Australia, Japan, and Portugal were also killed, according to Sri Lankan officials and foreign governments. The United Nations said at least 45 children, Sri Lankans, and foreigners were among those killed. Absolutely, just absolutely mind-boggling when you think about how outrageous this all has been. So, what can I tell you? Well, let's look at some other things that are happening. And this is really unbelievable change of demeanor. Ukraine evidently has defied its so-called anti-Semitic past with Zelensky's victory. It seems that comedian Volodymyr Zelensky his election will see Ukraine led for the first time by a president of Jewish descent in a landmark for a country with a long history of anti-Semitism. So the 41-year-old actor won a landslide victory against incumbent Petro Poroshenko on Sunday. His triumph has been hailed as a sign of tolerance in the ex-Soviet country, accused by some of having a lax attitude toward neo-Nazi groups. Ukraine already has a Jewish prime minister, Volodymyr Groysman, also 41, and who is to remain in office pending parliamentary elections scheduled for October. The chief rabbi of Ukraine and Kiev, Moshe Reuven Azman, called Zelensky's win a miracle. This says a lot about the maturity of the Ukrainian people. Relations between Ukrainians and Jews have not always been easy, he noted. Ukraine is the only country in the world, aside from Israel, where the president and prime minister are Jewish. Eduard Dolinsky, a Jewish community leader, wrote on Facebook, Zelensky has said he considers religion to be a private affair and has christened his children in the Orthodox tradition, according to Ukrainian media.
While the election campaign was fierce and saw opponents exchange various insults, Zelensky's ancestry was not used as a motive for attacks. This was far from trivial in a country where, during the Soviet period, as in the rest of the USSR, being Jewish was not considered a matter of faith, but one of nationality and marked as such on identity papers. Now, the first Jewish massacres in what is now Ukraine date back to the 17th century during an uprising against Polish rule led by Cossack military leader Bohdan Khmelnytsky, when thousands of Jews were killed. A thousand more were killed during another revolt against the Poles in the 18th century. Between 1917 and 1921, a period of fierce fighting between Russia's white and Bolshevik armies and Ukrainian nationalist armies was marked by a wave of pogroms. Now, Ukraine's Jews were almost wiped out during the Holocaust, in which some Ukrainians collaborated with Nazi authorities. In Babi Yar, a ravine in the outskirts of Kiev, 34,000 Jews were slaughtered in just 2 days in one of the worst single massacres of the Holocaust. The Ukrainians risked their lives to help Jews during the Nazi occupation, however, and more than 2,600 Ukrainians have been recognized as, quote, righteous among the nations, end quote, by the Yad Vashem Memorial Center in Jerusalem for saving Jews during World War II. Now independent, Ukraine has once again been singled out for alleged anti-Semitism. Far-right groups played an active role in the barricades of the 2014 pro-Western Maidan Revolution. The uprisings ousted a pro-Russian president and was followed by Moscow's annexation of Kiev's Crimea Peninsula and war with separatists in eastern Ukraine. Russia has denounced the pro-Western authorities in Ukraine as a neo-Nazi and fascist regime. Rabbi Moshe Reuven Azman said this is far from the case. The level of anti-Semitism in Ukraine is lower than in Russia and in Europe. I see it clearly, he said, and that's what I've learned as well. According to a study published last year by the American Pew Research Center, 5% of Ukrainian adults do not want to accept Jews as fellow citizens. This is a much lower rate than its neighbors, as the figure is at 14% in Russia, 18% in Poland, and 22% in Romania. An article in the Israeli daily Haaretz said Zelensky's victory did not mean the end of anti-Semitism in Ukraine, but represented a sense of Ukrainian nationhood, one that can be more at peace with its troubled past, which I think goes to the heart of it. And interestingly enough, the fourth largest Jewish community of all of Europe is Ukraine. The largest Jewish community in Europe is in France, then followed by Great Britain, Germany, and also then Ukraine. So very, very interesting to say the least. All right, let's look at some other things that are happening in our world. Let's look at what's going on in the Americas. Let me just quickly look. This is a little bit frightening, too, and it seems a deadly landslide has hit southwestern Colombia. 17 people have been killed and 5 injured in a landslide in the southwestern Colombian province of Cauca, the country's disaster relief agency said on Sunday. The landslide, which was caused by heavy rains, occurred early on Sunday in a rural area of Rosas municipality, the agency said in a statement. And on Sunday evening, an agency spokesman said the death toll had risen from the initial figure of 14. So 5 people were hospitalized, with 8 houses destroyed. A portion of the Pan American Highway was also blocked by the landslide. And President Ivan Duque will visit the area on Sunday evening with the Housing and Transport Minister to meet with relief officials, his office said in a statement. Landslides are common in mountainous Colombia, especially during rainy season and in areas where precarious informal housing and narrow roadways are constructed on deforested Andean hillsides. So very, very important to recognize, that's for sure. But it is definitely a problem. Now, what did I want to tell you about? I wanted to check with, bear with me, there's other news as well. I want to go first into the Middle East. Evidently, the U.S. has moved to end sanctions waivers for nations importing Iranian oil. So the Trump administration yesterday said it will no longer exempt countries from U.S. sanctions if they continue to buy Iranian oil, in a move that sparked condemnation from Tehran, as well as Iran's major oil importers, including China and Turkey. Now, U.S. President Donald Trump made the decision as part of the administration's maximum pressure, quote-unquote, campaign on Iran, and aims to eliminate all of its revenue from oil exports that the U.S. says funds destabilizing activities throughout the Middle East and beyond. And this decision is intended to bring Iran's oil exports to zero, denying the regime its principal source of revenue, the White House said in a statement. So announcing the step, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said no more sanctions waivers would be granted when the current batch expire on May 2, choking off Iranian income that had been more than $50 billion a year. The goal remains simply, quote, to deprive the outlaw regime of the funds that it has used to destabilize the Middle East for decades, and incentivize Iran to behave like a normal country, end quote, Pompeo told reporters at the State Department. The administration had granted 8 waivers when it reimposed sanctions on Iran in November after Trump pulled the United States out of the landmark 2015 nuclear deal. Now, the waivers were issued in part to give those countries more time find energy sources, but also to prevent a shock to global oil markets from the sudden removal of Iranian crude. And 3 of those waivers for Greece, Italy, and Taiwan are no longer needed because they have all halted their imports of Iranian oil. But the other 5 countries to import Iranian oil and had lobbied to their waivers to be extended. So the decision was promptly condemned by Iranian officials who denounced the move as illegal. Quote, since the sanctions in question are principally illegal, the Islamic Republic of Iran did not and does not value any or attach any value or credibility to the waivers given to the sanctions, the Iranian foreign ministry said in a statement strictly issued in its official website. So as they write in the beginning, which puts into question what they're saying, is since the sanctions in question are principally illegal. So what does that mean? So is it in principle or not in principle? Like what you know, the wording is just not exact. So Tehran reiterated a long-running Iranian threat to close the Straits of Hormuz if it's prevented from using the crucial waterway in the Persian Gulf through which a third of all sea passes. If we are banned from using it, we will close it, General Ali Reza Tangsiri, the head of the Iranian Revolution Guard's Navy, said, and he was quoted as saying so by the semi-official news agency Tasnim, T-A-S-N-I-M. And Iran has made similar threats before, and it was not clear if his remarks were related to Monday's announcement. So Turkey also criticized the move, with Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Cavusoglu saying, quote, it will not serve regional peace and stability. In a message posted on Twitter on Monday, Cavusoglu said, Turkey rejects unilateral sanctions and impositions on how to conduct retaliation with neighbors. Cavusoglu added the decision would harm the people of Iran. He tagged the U.S. State Department and Pompeo on the tweet. NATO said NATO ally Turkey has made the case that as a neighbor of Iran, Turkey cannot be expected to completely close its economy to Iranian goods. And there's also a challenge from the Chinese. China, one of Iran's largest customers, slammed the step, calling it more evidence of U.S., quote, unilateral sanctions and long-arm jurisdiction, end quote. China, which relies on imports for about half of its oil, could present the toughest diplomatic challenge for the United States in trying to enforce its sanctions. And those arguments fell on deaf ears within the administration. We will no longer grant any exemptions, Pompeo said. We're going to zero across the board. Left unclear by the United States decision is whether the five countries will face immediate American sanctions if they continue to take delivery of Iranian oil after the waivers expire. Kevin Hassett, the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors, told reporters at the White House he's not concerned that the decision will negatively affect oil prices. He said U.S. production has risen in recent years by more than all of Iranian production, so there is additional and adequate capacity should there be a need for oil supplies. He said the link between the private and the U.S. economy has diminished as American oil production has increased. And the Saudis and Israelis welcome the move. Meanwhile, Saudi Energy Minister Khalid Al-Fali said in a statement that his country would work with other oil producers, quote, to ensure adequate supplies are available to consumers while ensuring the global oil market does not go out of balance. Iran hawks on Capitol Hill, like Senator Ted Cruz, a Republican of Texas, who had long lobbied for the step, applauded the end of oil wafers. Quote, this decision will deprive the Ayatollahs of billions of dollars that they would have spent undermining the security of the United Nations and our allies after building up Iran's nuclear and ballistic missiles program and financing global terrorism. Israel's Air Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, meanwhile, praised the administration to further tightening sanctions enforcement on Iran, which the Jewish state regards as an existential threat. He said the move the move is of great importance for increasing pressure on the Iranian terrorist regime. So that's what Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu praised the administration for further tightening sanctions on Iran. So that's the story that's there. Let me just quickly look to see if anything else is transpiring in the Middle East that you would find interesting. Okay. That's like really the main story in the Middle East. Okay, I want to go over to Europe now. All right, 1 second. This is also just unbelievable. It seems the new IRA has admitted responsibility for killing Northern Ireland journalist Lyra McKee. It seems a dissident Republican group, the new IRA, on Tuesday admitted responsibility for killing Northern Irish journalist Lyra McKee during rioting in Londonderry last week in a statement to the Irish News. The new IRA offer our full and sincere apologies to the partner, family, and friends of Lyra McKee for her death. It said in a statement reportedly by the Irish newspaper, which said the paramilitary group used a recognized code word. McKee, 29, was shot in the head late on Thursday as dissident Republicans clashed with police in the Creggan housing estate in Northern Ireland's second city, which is also known as Derry. Now, the Northern Ireland Police Service said on Tuesday they have arrested a 57-year-old woman under the Terrorism Act in connection with the slaying of McKee. The arrest came as an Irish Republican Army splinter group admitted that one of its volunteers killed McKee. While admitting responsibility, the new IRA attempted to justify its actions by claiming she was killed during an attack on enemy forces, quote unquote, and accused police of provoking the riots that preceded her death. In the course of attacking the enemy, Lyra McKee was tragically killed while standing beside enemy forces, the statement advised. And on Thursday night, following an incursion of the Cregan, or the Cregan, by heavily British air sources, so on Thursday night, following an incursion on the Cregan by heavily armed British Crown forces, which provoked rioting, the IRA deployed our volunteers to engage. That's what the new IRA statement said, according to the Irish News. So in the wake of her death, Northern Ireland's six main political parties, including rival revisionists, unionists and Republicans, who have been unable to form a devolved government for more than 2 years, issued a rare joint statement. Quote, it was a pointless and futile act to destroy the progress made over the past 20 years, which has the overwhelming support of the people everywhere, he said. The killing of the latest upsurge in violence shakes the troubled youth. I guess those are some of the issues that have come into play. We'll probably learn more about this tomorrow as this comes to light. Well, I want to thank you all for being with us today, we hope to speak to you tomorrow. Let me just quickly look. Oh, yeah, tomorrow we're not going to be conducting a broadcast. The reason for that is I'm going to go to a court case to see some challenges that are being directed at some people who presented their signatures, and they need to invalidate them, should they be able to invalidate them. And if so, that will be presented back to us, and we will review whether it's on the level or not, and we'll return to that toward that end. And so that's a story there. All right, well, we'll say goodbye and thank you for being with us. All the best. Bye.